today on Against the Grain. It's been 50 years since 1968, a year of globe-spanning revolt and rebellion. What should we know about that explosion of protest, and what relevance does it have for today? I'm CS. Timothy Scott Brown talks about 68, and more generally what he calls the global 60s, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 1968 was huge. So many things happened in so many countries and in the context of so many social and political pressures and formations that to speak of 1968 as a unitary phenomenon is a kind of artifice. It serves as a kind of stand-in for a world historical protest moment that, even 50 years later, is being reassessed and re-examined. And then, of course, 1968 occurred in the context of the tumultuous years that preceded and followed it, which is why many people use the term 1968 in quotes, or refer to the global 1960s, or the long 60s. Still, there are some ideas and principles that united the various upheavals of 68, and it's definitely worth pondering their legacy and how they might inform or inspire struggles for social and economic justice in the current moment. Timothy Scott Brown has thought deeply about these and related issues. He is professor of history at Northeastern University, and his books include West Germany and the Global 60s, The Anti-Authoritarian Revolt, 1962 to 1978, and The Global 60s in Sound and Vision, Media, Counterculture, Revolt. His book 60s Europe is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. When Timothy Scott Brown joined me recently in studio, I began by asking him, since 60s radicals are often referred to as the new left, to describe the old left.
The old left is obviously a term that one doesn't start using until there's a new left, right? And so the old left, from the perspective of the new left, is that left that is centered in the classical communist and socialist parties. The socialist parties of the 19th century, and especially the communist parties of the 20th century, that is connected with a set of concerns having to do with, obviously, class is central, and the class struggle is central to the thinking of these parties. And the social basis of these parties is the working class, which predominantly means the industrial proletariat, which has the connotation of male factory workers. So the new left, in a way, in some of the ways it reacts against this, is it starts to privilege things that were left out of the equation of the old left. So if the old left is about workers in factories and it's about the class struggle, then the new left can be, you know, seen as trying to expand who the representatives of the revolution are, trying to open up new issues having to do with, you know, daily life and sexuality and all sorts of other things that weren't so much the centerpiece of old left politics.
What were the principal accomplishments of the old left?
Well, the principal accomplishments of the old left were to respond to the situation of immiseration of the working class that was created by the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, Marxism and various other types of socialist thought, and the socialist parties that spring up in the First International and also anarchism are all responses to a situation that, you know, wasn't created by the people who were impacted by it. It was created by, you know, larger forces, and namely the Industrial Revolution, the rise of capitalism. So the old left took as its responsibility coming up with an analysis of the situation of workers in a, you know, modernizing industrial economy under capitalism, and did things like organize workers in the International or various sort of working men and women's organizations, in some cases in organizing typically with, you know, the sort of followers of Mikhail Bakunin, people like that, organizing sort of insurrections or insurrectionary secret societies, but also the creation of trade unions and basically the establishment of certain basic rights that we now take for granted, right, but sort of form the necessary basis for there to be something that we would refer to as a new left.
And we're going to jump ahead. I mean, we're going to obviously leave so much behind, but maybe we'll fill out the historical picture as we go along. So in the 1950s and 60s, what happens to the landscape of revolutionary actors and agitators? Who joined their ranks? Who constituted their ranks?
Well, in the immediate post-World War II period, you have this sort of anti-fascist consensus, but it evaporates very quickly. I mean, there's these sort of national fronts, you know, in the various countries in Europe in which anti-fascists of different stripes get together and fight what is the obvious evil of Italian fascism and German Nazism. Relatively quickly, this sort of, you know, emancipatory unity gets sabotaged by the Cold War as early as 1947 or so, right? So there's this moment of post-war possibility that quite quickly gets into this situation of this Cold War deep freeze and all that means in terms of the two superpowers clamping down on movements in countries, you know, obviously in the Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe and also in the American sphere of influence in Greece and countries like that. There's, of course, the persistence of fascism in Spain, but also of fascist personnel and structures of thought in former fascist countries like Italy and Germany. And really, in the 1950s and 60s, there's the rise of a number of new groups across Europe and, of course, in the United States as well, who don't see themselves as being able to fit into the mold of the old left anymore. I mean, one primary reason for this is Stalinism, right? And even though Western communist parties, especially the French Communist Party, really refuse to break with Stalinism, I mean, that's a variegated picture across Europe. Some are more Stalinized than others. But they have massive support and they have an electoral presence, but the issues that they are talking about or interested in and the compromises that they have to make in terms of, you know, pretending that Stalinism is okay or that the Soviet Union is basically good is something that a lot of people can't swallow, right? And the big moment that comes when people can't swallow it is obviously 1956 when the Hungarian uprising happens. And there's attempts to form, you know, workers' councils and create some kind of new, freer version of socialism, and that's crushed by the Soviet Union. And so many intellectuals and just regular people in the West realize that communism, that Stalinized communism is a non-starter now, and that it basically isn't something that one can sign on to. So there's a bunch of different sources for something to replace this reliance on communist parties. So one of them is in youth culture, which really is something that starts in its modern form maybe in the late 40s and in the 1950s. This is sort of the culture of juvenile delinquency and rock music, which was called beat music in Europe at this time. And the idea of youth as this autonomous social force that has insurrectionary potential, even if it's not explicitly political, but it could be made political, right? So there are certain people who want to mobilize youth radicalism, juvenile delinquency as a political tool. And a main group there are the provos in Amsterdam, which we could talk more about at length if you want. But so that's one wing of this. Another comes out of the avant-garde in the arts, especially, you know, these sort of tendencies in France, for example, with the Lettrist or the Situationist International to find a place where art can be rejuvenated in the service of revolutionary projects so that art should no longer be something that's confined to the museum, but art should be a way of unsettling existing social relations and should have an explicit tie-in with different types of revolutionary politics. And one of the key things that comes out of the interventions of the Lettrist and the Situationist and people like that is the development of the art prank as a means of political struggle, right? So there's the famous one that Grail Marcus and other people have written about where the Lettrists go in Notre Dame Cathedral at Easter Mass and kidnap the priest and tie him up and put on his robes and then give a sermon wearing the priest's robes proclaiming the death of God. Mm. And then they, when they're discovered, they're chased out to the banks of the Seine and set upon by an angry mob of Christians, and they have to be rescued by the police. And there's a group in London, King Mob, who were operating out of this tradition later in the 60s, and they did another classic prank, which was to go into Selfridge's department store dressed as Santa Claus and give presents off the shelves to the children. So the store had to call the police and have Santa arrested, right? So these are ways in situationist parlance of creating the situation that reveals the underlying social relations behind daily life, right? So like, you know, in the case of Notre Dame, they're celebrating the love of Christ, but yet they want to kill the people who disrupted the service. And then in the case of the King Mob prank, they're expose the real existing economic relationships underneath property, right? So even though the kids are getting presents from Santa. So this sort of avant-garde art tradition and these pranks become really important in France and West Germany and the UK and the United States as a way of doing a new kind of politics that has very little obvious connection to the old left.
So you have these avant-garde artists and provocateurs. You have the youth culture, the burgeoning youth culture, with the associated music subcultures, the emergence of rock and roll. What other participants and agitators were part of this new left constellation?
So another important piece of this puzzle are students. And in the 60s, the student populations are massively expanding. And in many cases, they face authoritarian structures in the university, you know, professors just giving these lectures in this very top-down fashion, no participation, you know, sort of poor infrastructure or sort of alienating university campuses, and a feeling of a lack of participation, a feeling that they're being groomed to, you know, just be cogs in this consumer capitalist machine, right, which also has a component of imperialism and militarism to it as well. So students are very important. There's talk in the 60s of students, you know, making up a so-called new class, right? Like a class that can become a revolutionary subject in its own right as opposed to the industrial proletariat. And the problem with the industrial proletariat from the perspective of 60s radicals is that we can say in a general way it's no longer revolutionary or it's been bought off by capitalism. People are getting television sets and automobiles and things like that, and so they are less likely to rebel. It's actually not completely true that the working class wasn't able to rebel, though. I mean, obviously in May 68 in Paris, it turned into the biggest wildcat strike in history. Working class militancy is very strong in Italy, for example. So in some countries, the working class is relatively quiescent, like West Germany, the UK, and some countries it's quite radical, like in Italy and to an extent in France.
Timothy Scott Brown joins us in studio. He is professor of history at Northeastern University. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. And he joins us to talk about the global revolt of 1968. And I put that in quotes, and we'll talk with Tim about why he puts it in quotes and the continuing relevance of those events today. So what you're telling me then is the new left, the 60s radicals, they didn't see the working class as having the revolutionary potential or playing the revolutionary role that the old left did. So where does the new left look to, or who does the new left look to for filling this role, for occupying this role of revolutionary agent?
Well, the new left looks to, you know, new groups of actors like university students and artistic political avant-gardes and youth culture, and they also look especially to the revolutionaries of the Third World, because during the time of the student movements in the West, this is a period in which, you know, in France, for example, in the 50s, they were fighting the war in Algeria and the war in Vietnam, and then the U.S. inherited the war in Vietnam. There are struggles in Latin America and Africa. It's a period of worldwide anti-colonial revolt. And so a student in Europe could look at Castro or Che or even Mao and think that these are the people who are actually fighting the revolution because they're the people who are fighting the great hegemon of the United States. So that's one reason why the Third World looms so largely in the imagination of Western radicals in the 1960s.
Let's talk about some of the events of 68. Remind us what happened in France in May of that year.
Sure. Well, in France, there was a campus outside Paris in Nanterre where students who were influenced by Situationism started instigating various you know, sort of conflicts at the university in terms of disrupting the authoritarian structures, what they saw as the authoritarian structures of the university. And it spirals into this conflict with the authorities in which students end up taking over, you know, occupying buildings, you know, these sort of standard practices of the international student movement in the 60s, and then get put on trial. So there's always this dynamic of students being arrested and then the campaigns around their arrest. And so this is mishandled by the authorities, and it spirals into a sort of urban insurrection, which is driven partly or primarily, I would say, by the police overreaction. They call them the riot police, and they attack students and passerby and create a situation in which, you know, students see sort of the naked hand of oppression, as it were, right, under the police truncheons. And then they start to try to make contacts with the workers. The workers, driven in part by their own concerns, start doing wildcat strikes. And there's this whole sort of anti-authoritarian uprising from below, where workers revolt against the advice of union heads. They all revolt against the advice of the Communist Party. The French Communist Party does its best to stop this because the Communist Party has its own sort of position in French society that it wants to maintain. And it basically turns into a situation in which 20 million workers are on strike and the universities are in upheaval. And it vanishes relatively quickly, but it stuck very strongly in the radical imagination. It was influential at the time and has retained this sort of legendary status since then, in part, I think, because France is the seat of the modern revolution, right? And this sort of images of barricades in the Latin Quarter are very redolent of, you know, the French Revolution of 1789 and other French revolutions, the Paris Commune and so on. But also because it revealed the unwillingness to go along with business as usual that was lying right underneath the surfaces of daily life. And also, obviously, because of the poetic slogans of May 68 in Paris, like all power to the imagination and things like that.
The context of those uprisings was capitalism, a capitalist state. Another key event in 1968, and there were so many of them, was the Prague Spring. Remind us what happened there and what is the significance to you of the fact that that occurred in the context of a nominally socialist state?
So in the Prague Spring, there were tendencies toward reform developing within the Czech Communist Party. Czechoslovakia had had a fairly strong communist tradition compared to some of its Eastern European neighbors, but it also suffered more strongly under Stalinism than some of those and was actually relatively late to de-Stalinize. But when these reform tendencies started to develop, they kind of spiraled from the perspective of the Stalinist authorities out of control. And there was this idea of socialism with the human face. And when the Communist Party published its action program that involved things like creating freedom of the press or, you know, some liberalization of the press into censorship and things like that, the sort of birth of this nascent civil society that can't exist under Stalinism, right? And so ultimately, the Soviet Union decided that it couldn't allow this to happen, so they invaded Czechoslovakia in August 1968 and put an end to this experiment. But the significance of it from the perspective of it taking place in a communist country, for me, is that it actually shows that there were alternative visions of socialism that were crushed by Soviet communism that were still there and could still break out in different ways. I mean, you can talk about the question of whether the Prague Spring is a revolutionary moment because you could say, well, as many scholars do, well, they're seeking reform within the communist system. But I look at it slightly differently, that they're actually trying to realize aspects of socialism that were suppressed by the communist system, right? They take as their starting point the idea that socialism isn't socialism if there's not freedom of the press, if there aren't freedoms of assembly. And so since 1989 and the fall of communism, one tendency has been to say, look, you know, they wanted what, you know, we refer to as the bourgeois freedoms, right, of freedom of speech, assembly, and all that. And now they got it because in 1989, the communism fell. But this isn't really what they were after at the time. Even if many of the protagonists became very, you know, sort of like disillusioned with any sort of socialist project, later, which when one can't blame them, at that time, it was really an idea of a legitimate alternative version of socialism, a non-Bolshevik kind of socialism.
Timothy Scott Brown is his name. He teaches history at Northeastern University. His books include West Germany and the Global 60s, the Anti-Authoritarian Revolt, 1962 to 1978. And he co-edited the volume The Global 60s in Sound and Vision, Media, Counterculture, Revolt. His book, 60s Europe, is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what sets of ideas or principles, in your mind, unite the various uprisings of 1968 against different kinds of regimes, in different contexts, under different pressures? What could we say might be the core impulse of 68?
So what these movements have in common is an anti-authoritarianism that can arrange itself against different systems. So in the East, for example, in Czechoslovakia or Poland, this anti-authoritarianism can be aimed against the Bolshevik tradition as it's been passed down through Stalinism and the idea that socialism has to be a system in which no one has freedom to say anything or think or assemble or do anything outside the guidance of the Communist Party. In Western Europe, authoritarianism can be seen in the university or in the workplace or in more general terms in the idea that society is organized around consumption and grooming students to take their place as cogs in the capitalist machine and then do their civic duty by purchasing the goods produced by capitalism. So anti-authoritarianism really is a underlying root principle that works in all these situations. And another underlying root principle that works in all these situations is the idea that all struggles are connected. That means that, you know, students and other radicals in both East and West see themselves as part of a global struggle, and not just because they see themselves in the context of the Third World Liberation movements, but because they know what's going on in the other countries, they know what's going on the other side of the Cold War divide across the Iron Curtain. And they see that other people are fighting for the same things that they're fighting for.
You've described 1968 as a convergence followed by a divergence. What was the convergence?
The convergence is the convergence of various aspects of civil society in the West, like trade unions, church groups, the peace movement, with the rising student intelligentsia that's rooted in an increase in students who are at university, along with, you know, youth culture, along with avant-garde artistic groups. I speak in terms of a convergence because of the sort of amorphousness of the idea of 1968. I mean, often in daily parlance, we talk about 1968 as, you know, the crisis year where, you know, there was the Tet Offensive and, you know, the twin assassinations in the United States, or May 68 in Paris, or the crushing of the Prague Spring. But when scholars talk about 1968, we're referring to this kind of historical moment that starts maybe sometime in the late 1950s and goes into the 1970s. I mean, in my book in West Germany, I start in 62 and end in 78, right? So it kind of brackets the year 1968. So when I think in terms of a convergence, I'm thinking about the way that this historical moment begins and what sort of groups and concepts have to come together for us to start speaking of something that we can call 1968, or in the West German case, you know, the West German episode in this global 1960s or global 1968. And very clearly, in the year 68, in the West German case and the French case and a number of other cases, you see a divergence that I would say is even more clear than the convergence, right? The divergence is when groups, so let's say, take the West German example, two of the big campaigns in West Germany have to do with preventing the passing of these so-called emergency laws that allow the government to suspend civil liberties in the case of social unrest. That's one. The other has to do with the press monopoly, the Springer Press in West Germany, which is kind of like, I suppose, is kind of like the Rupert Murdoch of West Germany, if you want to look at it like that, right? So when these two campaigns fail in the second half of 1968, when they don't, you know, they have this campaign to expropriate Springer, right? And obviously, you know, that's a huge goal, and that doesn't happen. And they also fail to stop the emergency laws from being passed. And from this point on, there's a decision that has to be made about, you know, how can we continue our radicalism? What sort of avenues can we put our radicalism into? And connected to that is the question of who we need to be working with to do this. So, for example, for university students or countercultural radicals, especially for the university students, I think there's this idea that we students can't do this alone, right? So we either need to connect with the working class in a more or less classical Marxist fashion, or we need to do one of a number of other possible actions. So one of these can be to form neighborhood sort of action groups that can connect with local struggles and schools and factories. Another might be to form urban insurrectionary cells, which might be sort of like living the revolution at the level of daily life in communes, or could even bleed over into actual what they called quote-unquote armed struggle, i.e. terrorism, left-wing terrorism. It could involve, you know, going back to the lands, kind of like in America, the idea of, you know, the hippie counterculture and seeking out new vistas of, you know, personal liberation, collective liberation by escaping capitalism in the cities and getting out to the country and rebuilding their life anew, right? And then most important, or one of the most important and remarked upon directions in this divergence is the rise of second wave feminism and the women's movement, which really gets started at the end of the 60s and develops in the 1970s. And then there's also the Green Movement, which, you know, at the end of my West Germany book ends in 78 with the so-called Tunics Congress in West Berlin. And that's when the Greens get born. And that's another important aspect of this divergence.
So a significant strand of the New Left was Marxist, still believed in the potential of Marxist ideas. Now, for those who opposed authoritarian regimes, authoritarian nominally communist regimes, how was Marxism thought of? Because on the one hand, it could be seen as an ideological pretext for this one-party rule. But on the other hand, it could be viewed as a set of ideas that could lead the way, I guess if properly cultivated and implemented, could lead the way toward an emancipatory future.
Right. Well, there's a strong attempt within the student intelligentsia on both sides of the Iron Curtain to retrieve the original good Marx that's been corrupted by Marxism-Leninism. I mean, Marxism-Leninism is really a body of thought and practice that's codified by Stalin in the period after Lenin's death. And there's a strong recognition that, you know, one could, for example, turn to Marx's early writings and Alienation, for example, that one could really go back into the classics and find what's valuable. So, for example, in West Germany, Rudi Dutschke, the main student leader, puts a lot of stock in this idea of we have to retrieve, you know, the original good Marx. And he makes contacts with an older generation of Marxist intellectuals like Ernst Bloch as part of this project. Later, when one of the groups that I didn't mention in the divergence I did sort of mention them because there's this idea of going back to the working class, but this idea spawns the creation of all these little parties in Germany. In West Germany, they were called the Kaggruppen or the communist groups, who call themselves Marxist, Leninist, or Maoist groups and have the explicit goal of connecting with the industrial working class in a way that the student movement wasn't able to do. And this is connected to the idea that the basic project of Lenin and the project represented by Trotsky is a good project. So they could set themselves against Stalinism while retaining Bolshevism. And there's a strong counter-movement within 68 to also reject Leninism and Trotskyism. And obviously this is a project that anarchists are involved in. It's a project that, you know, the Situationist International is involved in. They take a dim view toward, you know, Marxism-Leninism, and they also actually take a dim view toward the third world struggles, third world liberation struggles, which they see as as a phenomenon that's held up by student radicals as an unequivocal good, when the actual politics of, you know, radicals in Vietnam or Cuba or whatever are don't actually withstand a lot of close analysis. Like, this was the argument, and they proved correct.
His name is Timothy Scott Brown. He's professor of history at Northeastern University. We'll take a short break and speak more with him about the global revolt of 68, understood to extend far beyond the year 1968. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. My guest, Timothy Scott Brown, teaches history at Northeastern University. He's the author of Weimar Radicals, Nazis and Communists Between Authenticity and Performance, and West Germany and the Global 60s, the Anti-Authoritarian Revolt, 1962 to 1978. And his book, 60s Europe, is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. Let's talk more about the anarchist strand of the New Left. How do you define anarchism, and what happened to people's interest in anarchism in the 60s?
So in the 60s, there are still surviving elements of interwar anarchism, and there's kind of especially a Spanish anarchist diaspora that sends former militants of the CNT FAI from Spain, you know, who had to leave Spain after the collapse of the Republic in the Civil War, and who take up residence in the UK, in France, in West Germany, in various places. So the idea of the Spanish Revolution and, you know, the anarchist militancy that saw workers seize control of factories in Barcelona and Catalonia and so forth exerts a real powerful pull on the radical imagination in 1968. But the anarchism that actually sort of grows up organically among young people doesn't have so much in common with this older guard of anarchists who, you know, who in their own way are a little bit old left, right? You know, industrial militants, right? And the new anarchism is more, tends to be more youth countercultural anarchism, but it's an anarchism. So in the case of the provosts in Amsterdam, I mean, they know, you know, interwar militants. Like, they engage in this, what I see as one of the key 68 projects, which is going back into the past and finding useful source material for use in the present, right? So one way of going back into the past is to actually make contact with militants of previous generations who are still around. And the Marxist intellectuals do that by trying to connect with Lukács and Ernst Bloch, for example. And on the anarchist side of things, the young militants also know, you know, the provosts, for example, were influenced by people that they knew from interwar Dutch anarchist groups. And there's a famous case in which a young Scottish anarchist, Stuart Christie, who knew people who were in the exile Spanish organizations, became involved in a plot to assassinate Franco, and he actually went to Spain and tried to assassinate Franco and was put in prison and somehow survived. And he's written a book called Granny Made Me an Anarchist, where he talks about the plot, his role in the plot to kill Franco. Anyway, anarchism is there in the presence of former radicals from Spain and elsewhere. Anarchism is there as a sort of commitment to turn youth revolt and juvenile delinquency into in revolutionary directions. Right? I mean, there's this idea in anarchism, for example, traditionally, that the revolutionary actor doesn't just have to be an industrial factory worker. It can be social outgroups, right? This is present even in the idea of Herbert Marcuse, who's really influential for student radicals in the 60s, the idea that maybe the revolution isn't going to come from the working class anymore. Maybe it's going to come from from out-groups, from third-world radicals, from juvenile delinquents, from various kinds of nonconformist actors. So anarchism informs the efforts of, for example, the Provos or the Kommune Eins in West Germany, and groups like that informs their efforts to come up with a new sort of political praxis that is based on new actors, right? That doesn't, because if the working class isn't revolutionary, we have to look elsewhere. Also, the core concept of anarchism is that people do self-organization, self-management. So sometimes there are people active in the 60s who see themselves explicitly as anarchists, but in other cases, they're pursuing a basically anarchist line, whether they call themselves anarchist or not, right? So if they focus, for example, on self-management, on workers' control of the factories, or the right of citizens to control a neighborhood, district, or an apartment building, or to squat an apartment building, all these ideas and practices are kind of bound up with these ideas of anti-authoritarian self-management. And this is really important in the 60s. And it's one reason why communist parties and sort of 68-type radicals don't always get along very well in the 60s.
Since none of the revolutionary formations of the new left actually seized power, and since culture was so important to the new left, as you've been saying, the youth culture, art, publishing, new ideas being circulated, can we then say that a kind of cultural revolution was effected by 60s radicals as opposed to a political revolution that may not have been realized or accomplished or implemented?
Well, we can certainly say that there wasn't a political revolution in the sense of an overturning of existing social and political relations. We can also say that there was a cultural revolution, although that term has been used in a number of different iterations that have kind of a different political valence. So, for example, one often talks about the cultural revolution of the 1960s in the sense meant by someone like the British historian Arthur Marwick, who really focuses almost solely on changes at the level of daily life and the way people think about their lives and possibilities of consumption and changing mores in the realm of the family and sexuality and all that kind of stuff, and downplays very much the attempts of radicals to make any sort of more thoroughgoing change to social and political relations. And some scholars have talked about cultural revolution in what I see as a more nuanced way, in terms of seeing how political ideas were articulated through cultural practices, right? Like at the level of daily life or through consumption or through artistic production and things like that. And you have certain former radicals. One thinks, for example, of Daniel Clemendit, who was the student leader in May 68, who...
In France,
who came along later and said, well, you know, we won the Cultural Revolution because we changed not just, you know, issues of daily life and consumption, but we created a freer culture. But it's a good thing that our political ideals of syndicalism or anarchism didn't get put into place, because it would have been disastrous. So, you know, this is the purported wisdom of hindsight. And certainly people as they age are prone to and certainly have the right to have a critique of their youthful radicalism. I'm a little bit skeptical about placing too much attention on the utterances of former radicals, which might seem funny in a way, because you would think that they would be the repository of knowledge. And on one level, they are the repository of knowledge. But on another level, I consider paying too much attention to what they say. I refer to this as the veteran fallacy, right? The idea that the veteran acquires but then retains for however many more decades they live the right to adjudicate disputes about the events in question.
Because
their mind changes about what they did. But as we study the historical moment, what concerns me and what I'm interested in is what they thought then, not what they think when they're old later,
gotcha.
Right?
I'm joined in studio by Timothy Scott Brown. He is a professor of history at Northeastern University. His forthcoming book is called 60s Europe. And his new book project is titled The Greening of Cold War Germany, environmentalism and social movements across the wall and beyond, 1968 to 1989. And we're talking about 1968 in the broad sense. Some people call it the global 1960s. Some people call it the long 1960s. But certainly 1968, that tumultuous year, concentrated a lot of activism and ferment. So we've talked a lot about 68, and there's so much more to be said. I wonder if you could sort of try and sum up what you see as the meaning of 1968. What do we need to keep in mind about kind of the essential messages and stances of 68?
Well, I think one of the things that's important about 1968 is that, I mean, in historical terms, it challenged the Cold War. It weighed in on behalf of decolonization. So it took up a bunch of positions that have aged very well in terms of opposition to Soviet communism that was simultaneously opposition to, you know, U.S. imperialism, the war in Vietnam, and so on and so forth. It tried and in part succeeded to break down authoritarian structures in society. And 1968 is important as one of the last moments in which there was a challenge, a thoroughgoing challenge to capitalism as it exists now. It was obviously, it was a challenge to communism as well, but communism is no longer with us. In the period after 1989, there was talk of the end of history, that, you know, Western democracy and consumer capitalism were the sort of endpoint. And I think it's pretty clear at this point that that's kind of a flawed concept. But I think 68 showed that it was possible to dispute conditions that are very similar to our current conditions. And I guess what's interesting is how in the 50 years since 1968, it's become really difficult to imagine alternatives to capitalism. I mean, who's the famous quote by that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism?
Jameson?
I think it's Jameson.
Frederick Jameson. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's Jameson. We can look it up, though, anyway. But and I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And I think 1968 retains a place in the imagination, and in particular in the radical imagination, because it's a moment not so long ago when it was possible to imagine an alternative to capitalism. 1968 is also, of course, the source of some of the strands of emancipatory practice that are still with us. For example, the rise of what we refer to now as identity politics, of feminism, of gay rights movements, and so on and so forth. So in some ways, some aspects of the sort of late 68 critique that becomes really prominent in the 1970s have become received wisdom in a good way. And some of the other critiques that have to do with the role of class or the question of whether capitalism is a sensible system for the organization of human societies have received less attention. But these questions were put very strongly on the table in 1968, and I think that's one reason for its enduring relevance.
How important is it to you that the New Left wasn't driven so much by materialist concerns, by concerns about having enough to eat and meeting other basic needs?
What's important about that to me is how much it's not the case now. That's what really appears strongly to me from the vantage point of 50 years out. So in the 60s, there was a basic assumption that issues of material plenty had been solved in the West, right? Like, obviously, that wasn't the case in the Third World, but I mean, it was possible, for example, for the Situationists to think that one of the key sort of revolutionary problems was the problem of boredom, that we need to learn to live authentically, live without dead time. But it's like now, under neoliberalism, we live in a situation in which those things aren't taken for granted anymore at all. So what's striking about 68 is how much there was this historical moment in the 1950s and the 1960s when, in some level, capitalism had produced some plenty and created a situation for certain citizens to think that survival wasn't the problem. So then you could turn to a higher order of concerns, which might have to do with fulfillment, for example, or might have to do with some sort of intellectual, spiritual progress, but it wasn't just simply bound up with those sorts of things, though, because there was always an eye on poverty, for example, in the United States. I mean, the 60s movement really comes out of the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King's activism for the poor and so on and so forth. So there was always a critique of want, misery, war, imperialism. That was very strong in the 60s, but that coexisted with the rise of a post-materialist society that allowed people to strive for higher order goals. And it's a sad reflection of our current time that we can no longer, that we no longer consider ourselves in a post-materialist situation.
And, you know, many of the students, for example, in the U.S., with Students for a Democratic Society, many of them were kind of accused of being spoiled kids, right? That they were from reasonably well-off or very well-off families. And so, you know, who were these revolutionaries and how authentic could they be given their class position in society?
Well, I think that argument rests on a debased deployment of the idea of social class. You know, I mean, Marxism didn't posit this monolithic working class against which everything else was going to be judged. If Marx had been around in the 1960s, he would have been on the side of student radicals because he would have seen that they were involved in the process of trying to produce large-scale social change that required not just the emancipation of people who worked in factories, but involved everyone's emancipation and not just their emancipation from want or physical needs, but their emancipation from the sort of, you know, psychic parameters that were passed down to them by the reigning social system, right? So obviously this idea of spoiled children or that students were spoiled and didn't have the right to their radicalism doesn't really, it doesn't really hold a lot of water. I mean, this idea is an idea aimed at policing what's politically permissible for the young.
And what about the contradiction in the 60s between those who, and I think you alluded to it earlier, who wanted to kind of drop out of society, and we're speaking in significant part about the counterculture, as opposed to those who wanted to transform society? How important was that contradiction, and to what extent did it dilute what the new left, what 60s radicals were able to do?
I see this contradiction as one that's inherent in any post-1945 radical movement and actually probably in earlier periods too, although less prominent there, obviously. But the idea that there's going to be a monolithic block of revolutionary actors, you know, doesn't stand up to a lot of scrutiny, right, in terms of the possibility of such a thing actually existing in the real world, because as we know, people have widely varying views and perspectives. And I think that this is partly why I use this idea of convergence and divergence, because under convergence, it was possible to think that all these things went together. And in the period of divergence, things diverged, but they diverged because they were never part of the same thing to begin with. They're only provisionally part of the same thing in the sense that they were happening at the same time and people could think in that moment that, yes, you know, the hippies are a radical force. You know, working class militants are a radical force. There's this idea that we're moving towards some kind of crisis moment or some sort of millennial moment in which all these energies are going to coalesce and overthrow the system. But when that doesn't happen, the fact that these things were always on parallel tracks becomes obvious. And that's really what the divergence is, right? It's the idea that all these things are part of some unitary moment, some 1968 moment, is revealed to be something that just people believed for a short period of time, but it wasn't actually the case. And it's a natural thing in, for example, in Western society, the idea of, I mean, it goes back into the 19th century and earlier in the Transcendentalist and so on and so forth, the idea that there's some sort of higher reality that can be accessed, you know, in quietude or accessed in communion with one's fellow men and animals in a small group, that society on some level is corrupt or corrupting. This is a perennial position that one could take, right? And it comes out strongly in the late 60s and in the 70s and is one feature of this sort of millenarianism of the 60s and 70s. And there was always in the 60s a split in the United States. We talk of the movement and the counterculture, right? The movement is not the counterculture, but there was a strong feeling that the movement and the counterculture belonged together. And in some ways they did, and they cross-fertilized each other. that it was inevitable that these things would split off when people begin facing the hard questions of, you know, we're not just trying to, that they're not just trying to reform the system, but they're trying to revolutionize the system. It then becomes necessary to figure out how you're going to do that. So, for example, in the United States, you know, Students for a Democratic Society with the Port Huron Statement, you know, they were interested in the twin issues of racism and the Cold War, and the movement very much becomes involved with the Vietnam War as the 60s go on. So it really becomes a movement oriented less towards solving America's problems of racism and, you know, poverty and things like that, or the broad sort of meta category of the Cold War and the threat of nuclear destruction, but it ends up being about this war and all the, you know, the destructive things that that's connected with or come out of that. But basically what I was trying to say is that SDS has these set of concerns that have to do with just making a society that's basically okay better. And there's this idea in America that also exists in West Germany and some other countries that the country's basically right, but we need to make it better because it has these certain problems. And this is why I place a lot of emphasis on the role played by cognitive dissonance. And I argue that these movements really become radicalized when they realize that the claims of authority and the claims of the parent generation in the society actually don't bear up to any scrutiny, right? So in the United States, the students in SDS know that the country has a legacy of racism. They know that there are problems of poverty and that they know that the U.S. is involved in an arms race that could end humanity. But, you know, there's a reason why in the Port Huron Statement they talk about the Constitution, right? Because they're basically like young, intelligent people who've bought into the American system. And what happens over the course of the 60s is that buy-in is shattered by police violence, by the war in Vietnam, by all sorts of actions of elites that allow people to no longer – that don't allow people any longer to think that the society is basically good. So there are these liminal moments, 1956 in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia, you know, various 1968 events in the United States, like the assassinations of RFK and Martin Luther King, for example, or the war in Vietnam more generally. These things make it impossible to continue thinking that the country is basically okay. And this happens across societies, this moment of cognitive dissonance.
Timothy Scott Brown, he's professor of history at Northeastern University. Again, his books include West Germany and the Global 60s and The Global 60s in Sound and Vision, which he co-edited. His book 60s Europe is forthcoming from Cambridge University Press. Thanks, Timothy, so much for joining me in studio and talking about your work.
Thanks for having me, CS.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.